There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
Ah, the periodic table. Do you remember having to memorize the periodic table of elements? There were fewer of them when I was a kid. Had to memorize them. Oh, remember. Do you ever wonder why it was so important? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We'll have some fun today taking a look at the periodic table of elements and talk about some other things with our guest today, Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison, known for his leadership in national science policy, promoting excellence in science education at all levels, and for his development and use of demonstration work in teaching chemistry. So we'll be talking with him about the history of the periodic table today. We'll talk Earth Day, of course, that's coming up, and take your calls. Do you have a favorite element? What science issues are you concerned about? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Always happy to be with you, Larry, and with the listening audience. Such a fabulous audience. I run into so many people who listen to your program, not only in the Madison area, but far away from Madison, in all parts of Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, most recently in Minnesota. So thank you for having me again, Larry. And it is the International Year of the Periodic Table. 150 years ago, Dmitri Mendeleev proposed a way to organize the elements that were known at that time. And this year, we mark that anniversary. And as with all anniversaries and birthdays and so on, it's a time to reflect, but it's also a time to think about the proper use of those elements, their proper disposal, safe disposal, and their benefits. But I'm really curious, Larry, do you have a favorite element?
I don't. I don't have a favorite element.
Do you know what Bucky Badger's favorite element is?
No.
Well, he's never told me, but I kind of associate Bucky Badger. Oh. Badger, you get the hint there, Badger, with maybe someone from the listening audience will call and tell us about the connection between the one element in the periodic table that relates
to Bucky Badger.
To the nickname of our state. You've invited other people to call us and tell us about their favorite elements, so maybe they can also tell us what they think Bucky's favorite element is.
I think I know what it is, but I'm not going to say. We'll let our listeners tell us. And by the way, you can join in with your questions again, 1-800-642-1234. If you know the answer, you can give it to us, and if you don't have to, if you don't want to, but you can ask any questions you'd like to do. So why is this considered to be one of the most significant achievements in science?
It is a triumphant achievement in terms of organizing the different elements that were known at the time and continue to be discovered and not really discovered, they continue to be synthesized according to their properties. Initially, it was according to the weight of the element. Mm-hmm. But over the years, with advances in science, advances in technology, we have for some time now placed the elements in a table that has repeated periodicity. These elements are arranged according to their chemical behavior, to their chemical mm-hmm. properties. They're arranged in groups up and down the table and rows from left to right in the table. And it is really, as I say, a triumphant achievement in terms of seeing patterns. That's what we do in science. We look for patterns. You know who else looks for patterns? Musicians.
Yeah.
And other parts of human endeavor too, but specifically music and science. We look for patterns, and these repeated patterns of behavior help us organize the different elements and recall what their properties are and so on. It isn't really all that important to memorize all the symbols and names of the elements in the periodic table. There are about 118 elements in the periodic table now. Many of them have been synthesized in the past 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
And it is a very useful device. It's a useful tool. And it's important for people to recognize that, and this is why in school sometimes we ask the students to memorize the table. It's important to recognize that these symbols of the elements have meaning, have significance. For example, the element potassium has a symbol of K, mm-hmm. not P,
yeah.
where the element phosphorus has the symbol P.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, Shell Lake has an answer for us, I think. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me now?
Yes,
hello?
We can. Yeah, we can hear you now.
Wonderful. I'm in my car in front of the Shell Lake Post Office. And I'm thinking the element associated with badgers obviously is lead.
You got it. Why? What? Why? Why? Tell us more, Steve.
Well, you know, we have the miner on the state flag.
Yeah.
And badgers live in holes, and so did the early settlers in Wisconsin that were mining lead.
Yeah. You're exactly right, Steve.
You're right, sir. And what is your own favorite element, Steve, if you have one?
Iron. Iron. Fe. Iron.
Yes. Yeah. Why is that?
Well, it goes back. I'm kind of a history buff. And the Iron Brigade from Wisconsin in Gettysburg made a fantastic stand and saved our country.
You know, I guess that's as thank you, Steve. I guess that's as good as a reason as any to like iron.
Very good reason, and the usefulness of those elements and the connections that we make between the names and symbols and the uses that we put those elements to. That's important. But you know, lead has been around for a long time, since Roman days, and. It is a useful element in many ways, but it's also insidious because it is toxic.
Yeah.
And in our state, not only in Milwaukee, but other parts of the state, lead paint was used.
Used in every part of the state, as a matter of fact, probably.
That's right. And so that affects our health. There are serious issues with that. And so we need to learn about chemicals, their properties, their usefulness, proper disposal of them. That's part of the joy of being in science. That's part of the joy of communicating science with people, of course, in your listening audience, but everywhere. And thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. And by the way, I have to say, if Bassam should ever forget one of the elements, he could always just look at his tie that he has on today because his tie has the periodic table of elements on it.
It is the International Year of the Periodic Table, so my tie has symbols and other entries from the periodic table. And, Larry, we have on the internet now, you can just find just about anything you want. And so you can get these ties ordered on the internet. You can get socks ordered on the internet. So I brought
you got some socks.
So
too.
I brought you some socks here. So maybe you can describe them.
They are a bright blue, and they have all of the all of the elements of the periodic table on them.
They have not all of them.
Many of them.
Many of them.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah. They're not all.
The
yeah.
graduate students in the chemistry department at UW-Madison designed a T-shirt which I hold up here.
Oh, the state of Wisconsin with many of the elements of the periodic table.
Can you call off some of the symbols that you can?
Oh, let's see. What are we? Well, you're moving it too much. I can't read it that fast. So we're looking at chromium, manganese, molybdenum,
technetium.
Technetium.
Yes.
Vanadium,
yes.
Titanium,
yes.
Rhenium, tungsten.
You know, Larry, you know that 85% of the elements in the periodic table are metals. And so the ones that you are just calling off are metallic.
Yeah.
Technetium is one that is kind of an interesting one. They're all interesting, but it's different. Its location in the periodic table, of course, reflects its properties. But how it was discovered and what it's used for and how it is made is an interesting story by itself.
Tammy in Reedsburg, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. I knew that my answer was incorrect, but really I like it better. So my thoughts for Bucky's favorite element was tungsten. And I think the reason why I thought that is obvious.
Yes. Is it the symbol?
Yes. Yeah.
And what is the symbol? Tammy?
W.
Yes.
I was one of those kids at 57. I had to memorize this stuff in chemistry. And so then when I heard lead, of course I was disappointed, but I was like, PB, I remember that one too.
Well, we all have different, we make different associations with what we learn in school, what we learn outside of school, with a variety of things. But tungsten is a very interesting element in itself. In fact, I'd like to call the attention of our audience here to an excellent book written by the neurologist Oliver Sacks.
Yeah.
It's called Uncle Tungsten. It's about his chemical boyhood. That's the title of the book, Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. Oliver Sacks died about 4 years ago, but he grew up in England, and his uncle had a tungsten factory. They made filaments for light bulbs. It's a fascinating book. I urge everyone who has an interest in science to look at Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. A fascinating book.
Tammy, you're going to have to look that up. Thank you so much. And I like your reasoning on that, by the way. Thank you very much for calling. We're going to take some more calls here. But just a reminder, our guest today, Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the University of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Having some fun talking today with Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. We've been visiting about the periodic table of elements. I know we're also going to talk about global warming, and we've got Earth Day coming up, so things to talk about with him. But let's take some more calls. The number, by the way, is 800-642-1234. Give us a call. And let's see, who's been waiting? Bob in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Larry. Hi, Dr. Shakashiri. I just had a quick thought about Bucky's favorite element. Perhaps carbon would fit because of buckyballs.
Ah.
Well, what is that connection, Bob? Can you say more about that before I get to say more?
Buckminster fullerene and carbon making it up, and I just thought the name might fit. So
that's a very good observation, and it's a good connection. So carbon is an element. It's element number six. That means it has six protons. That's what differentiates elements from each other, the number of protons that they have in the nucleus. And element number six exists in different forms. They are called allotropes. That's the name that we give to the different forms of an element, because they all have the same atomic number. They all have six protons. And everyone knows about one allotrope of carbon. It is, Larry, what is one allotrope of carbon that very, very familiar? Very familiar.
You saw me while I was typing something here.
Well, I'll give you a hint, charcoal.
Okay.
But there's another allotrope of carbon that is also very familiar and is very precious. And
diamond?
Diamonds, yes. That's the second allotrope of carbon. The third one, the one that Bob is referring to, is 60 carbon atoms connected together, bonded together, and it was discovered in 1985. The report of its discovery was in 1985, and it is in the shape of a ball, like a soccer ball,
mm-hmm.
but it's named Buckyball. It's after Buckminster Fuller. Mm-hmm. In fact, those 60 carbon is that are connected together. They're called buckyball because the shape is the same as the geodesic shape that Buckminster Fuller had proposed. So that's a very good connection, Bob. It is not totally accurate, but that's all right.
But who cares? That was a good one, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to David in Rock Springs. Hi, David.
Hi there. I needed to get it off speakerphone, but I wanted to say, Bassam, you beat me to it. I wanted to mention Uncle Tungsten, and that's one of my favorite books. Oliver Sacks is one of my favorite authors, and I believe Tungsten is I don't know if it's Latin, but is it called Wolfram, the W?
Yes, that's where the W comes from, yes.
Okay, and I also wanted to mention I have a T-shirt. My wife bought me a T-shirt of the periodic elements, and it says, the saying on it is, I periodically wear this T-shirt when I feel like I'm in my element. So it's
fabulous. And what element number is Tungsten? Do you know?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Well, you know, when someone asks a question like this, it's very easy to look it up. It's in the middle of the periodic table, and it's element number 74 is what it is.
Okay.
Yeah. But that tells us something about its properties. It tells us something about its behavior, and it is a very difficult metal to inscribe on. When Oliver Sacks came to visit Madison way back in 2001, I wanted to give him a piece of tungsten with the flying W inscribed on it.
Uh-huh.
And I could not do it myself. I had to get some help from my engineering friends, and they succeeded in doing that. And I know he kept it and cherished it for a long time.
Oh, wonderful. David, thank you so much. I appreciate your call. By the way, you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Troy in Baraboo, it's your turn. Hi, Troy.
Yes, I was wondering. Recently, I saw a non-traditional representation of the periodic table. Instead of the left and right, up and down, sort of dress, right, dress, it's more of the elements are out on tangents. And it is the best I can describe it. Could you talk about that significance and how that representation might help us understand?
Yes, thank you, Troy, for this question. It's a very good question. And if you go to my website, I invite you and everyone else to go to my website, scifun.org, scifun.org. On the left-hand side, you will see an entry that says periodic table. And there you will see a display of a variety of forms of the periodic table. And your question is a very good one. Why are there different forms? That's because scientists have tried to organize these elements according to their properties and to their behavior. And there are circular forms, there are tabular forms, that the familiar one that we know about. And if you go there to the website, scifun.org, on the left-hand side, periodic tables, you will You should be able to find the answer to your question in more detail. But more importantly, you'll be able to see the variety of periodic tables that have been that I placed there. I didn't do all of them, but there's enough of those placed there. And while you are there, I invite you to visit the video of different elements in the periodic table where my colleague from England, Professor Martin, Sir Martin Polyakov, has made videos of the properties of different elements. And it is the properties and the behavior of the elements that causes us to try to arrange them in convenient ways to display and convenient ways to use.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Troy, for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's take another call. Mark in Richland Center. It's your turn. Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I want to go back to this question about tungsten and the properties of tungsten. There is a light bulb that celebrated a 100th year birthday of constant running at a firehouse in California, and you mentioned that tungsten was used in the manufacture of light bulb filaments. What is the property, maybe specifically of that light bulb that's been burning for 100 years, but what is it about these filaments that we have today that can't operate the same way?
I don't know about this bulb, but it's been burning for 100 years. Is it made of tungsten?
Well, that's my question. I don't know what it's made out of, but you had mentioned tungsten as an element that was used in the manufacture of the filaments for light bulbs, and this particular light bulb has been burning nonstop for 100 years, and they had a celebration for it. It's at some firehouse in California. I don't remember exactly where, but the filaments that we have in light bulbs today don't last for nearly that amount of time. 2,000 hours, I think, is the maximum life expectancy, and this is an incandescent bulb operating on AC electric. So I just find it interesting that there is, the possibility to manufacture stuff, and it has to do with the properties of the various materials that the filament would be made out of in order to achieve that longevity.
Yeah,
that's a very good observation, Mark. I don't know anything other than what you told me about this bulb. I'm going to have to...
You're going to have to look that up put it up on your website.
That's what we always do, Larry. We get questions. We explore. And I will post something in the next couple of days about this once I learn more about it. But tungsten is the element that's used because it gives off light energy, but it's not very efficient. In fact, it's terribly inefficient. About 80 to 90% of what the tungsten does is it gives off heat. And that's why all of us, as we take responsibility for what we do in our daily lives. That's why all of us, as we practice stewardship for the protection of our planet, we should switch to LEDs, to light-emitting diodes, because they are superior in terms of energy conservation. And we don't waste any power generating light, where 90% of it is dissipated as heat. We don't need to do that. So that's my plea to everyone in the listening audience, to switch to light-emitting diodes in our homes and elsewhere. And I'm about 85, 90% completed now, the switch in my home to LEDs.
Yeah, I think I am 100%, actually. I just... It took quite a few years, to be perfectly honest, because you don't want to throw the other bulbs out. You want to use up the bulb, but I finally think I've got them all. There may be one hiding somewhere in a corner that I haven't seen, but I think I've got them all.
Well, we have to exercise judgment about this, but we should really vigorously move in that direction.
Yeah.
And it's very important. And I hope the next time I'm on your program, Larry, I will be able to tell you that I am 100% LED now.
Marilyn emailed, by the way. She thought Bucky should have loved calcium because of its availability in dairy products and its health benefits, and it's present in limestone, which is abundant in Wisconsin.
Such enlightened audience that you and I visit with, Larry, and such great connections that people make between the topic for today, which is the element and so on, and various aspects of society. Yes, calcium is essential to life, and it is in our bones. And so that's a very good connection. Thank you.
John in Appleton has something about that 100-year-old bulb, I think. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. Well, in Appleton here, we have a home called the Hearthstone, which was the first home in the U.S. to be lit by a centrally located hydroelectric plant. It was an Edison generator. And to my knowledge, today there are still some of the original Edison light bulbs still burning, you know, in the year 2019. Which is, you know, a phenomenal lifespan. So my understanding of this with the light bulb issue that was talked about earlier is that, oh, back in the 20th century, maybe it was around the 1920s or 30s, the leading light bulb manufacturers suddenly realized that they were not getting very many repeat customers because their bulbs lasted so long. So this was one of the first examples of what you might call corporate conspiracy or corporate collusion or what have you, but all the manufacturers got together and said, look, we're going to limit the lifespan of our light bulbs to like maybe 2,000 hours or something, and they all agreed to do it so they could just generate a constant stream of repeat customers. So it has nothing to do with trying to engineer a long-lasting bulb. They just didn't want to do it.
That's interesting, John. And may I ask you how you learned all that?
Just by listening to the radio and reading articles and whatnot.
Curiosity is part of what drives us to excel as human beings. And thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to Bruce and Holman next. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm interested in an isotope of helium called helium-3. And it's relatively rare on Earth, but apparently it's abundant in samples of lunar soil that were brought back from the Apollo missions. And the reason that it's interesting is, as I remember, there was some research being done at the University of Wisconsin into using it as a potential fuel for fusion reactions, because it fuses at a low temperature, relatively low temperature, relatively low pressure, and it doesn't give off as much gamma radiation as hydrogen, some other fuels for fusion. And it was a big deal a couple years ago about a potential power source, you know, that could be developed to ease our power needs for the future. And it seems to have dropped off the radar. I haven't heard much about it. And at the time, it seemed as though it was kind of driving this desire to get back to the moon, because if it could be mined and brought back to Earth and actually used to as a fusion fuel, it would be a tremendous boon to mankind. Do you know anything about helium-3?
Yes. It is an isotope of helium, which, by the way, is different than being an allotrope. I talked about allotropes before, yeah. But isotopes are different of the same element. And it is, as you say, used in research in fusion. This is where you take two light elements that have small atomic numbers and see, by fusing them, a lot of energy can be released. And the fusion research at UW-Madison and elsewhere around the country continues. Has it not been as successful as we would like it to be? Yet it would be a source of clean energy, because there'll be no radioactive material emitted, unlike fission, where you take a heavy element and then you bombard it and it breaks down into smaller elements and releases a lot of energy. That's the basis of fission reactions. So, yes, helium is used, among other things, in these research projects that are carried on. And it is not as common as one would like. But I appreciate the fact that you took interest in it. And thank you, Bruce, for sharing that with us.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. Appreciate it. Before we get to Diane I had something here I wanted to show you. Oh, let's see here. I had a photo that I wanted to show you, and we just lost it. So, well, instead of that, oh, there we go. I had a photo of Oliver Sacks.
Oh, is he wearing a periodic table T-shirt?
Yeah, wearing a periodic table T-shirt.
Yeah.
There he is.
Yeah.
Matthew sent a photo of him wearing his periodic table T-shirt, which is pretty cool.
Yes, that's Oliver. And I will tell you that that's my second favorite picture of Oliver wearing a T-shirt. My favorite picture of Oliver wearing a T-shirt is when he's wearing the Science is Fun T-shirt.
Oh, there you go.
When you go to my website, you'll find it there.
Yeah, Matthew.
Matthew and Warren, your turn. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Larry. This is Matthew. I'm the same one that just sent you that picture of Oliver.
Oh, okay.
And I print those T-shirts in Warren, Illinois, right below the Illinois-Wisconsin border. And it's we just sent a shipment of those off to the American Chemical Society for their annual meeting. And it has all 118 elements, and all the radioactive elements glow in the dark. And Oliver Sacks, a friend of mine, called me up and said, you know, Oliver Sacks is on television wearing one of your T-shirts. And because of the book Uncle Tungsten, he ended up wearing one of our periodic T-shirts pretty much every day if you go by all the photographs of him in it. And we keep updating it as the new elements were discovered. And so I sent him an updated version of the shirt, and he sent me back a copy of the Uncle Tungsten book autographed, so it became a very precious memento of the relationship. And as your guest said, unfortunately, he died just a few years ago.
Yeah.
But he was quite an interesting fellow.
He was indeed very interesting. He was a neurologist, a writer, an outstanding human being in terms of making connections between science and the arts, connecting science with his patients. He was a good friend. Upon his death, I wrote a small op-ed piece in the American Chemical Society, a weekly publication, Chemical and Engineering News. I, along with my colleague Roald Hoffman from Cornell University, wrote that piece. But you know what, Larry? Before that, 3 years before that, on his 80th birthday, we wrote, Hoffman and I wrote another op-ed piece saluting him on his 80th birthday. Element number 80 is mercury. And this metallic element is a liquid. It's right in the middle of the periodic table, surrounded by other elements that are hard, solids, and this element is a liquid. And I know in conversations I have with students and colleagues, why is it that mercury is a liquid? And how does it fit into the periodic table? So organizing the elements in the periodic table, it helps us ask questions, raises our curiosities, and also makes us want to satisfy that curiosity. And so I ask that question now to all people who are listening. Why is mercury a liquid in the midst of all of these solid elements? I know the answer has to be technical in nature, but you know, it's just curious. And it's fascinating. Yeah. And I'll say one other thing about mercury. In Barcelona, in Spain, there is a mercury fountain.
Oh.
It's enclosed because mercury is also very, very, very toxic. But if you go to my website, scifun.org, and go on the left-hand side, you will see a periodic table, and you click there, and you'll actually see a picture of this this element.
But Sam, I know we're here, our time is flying by here, and I know that there are some things you wanted to talk about, where you've been going, what you're up to. Earth Day is coming up, Monday.
Earth Day is a celebration of our stewardship of our planet, and all of us should take special care to become more informed about the effects of global warming. Global warming is unequivocal, and we all must pay attention to that. We in Wisconsin, we in the United States, everywhere around the world, everyone around the world should pay attention to that. And very recently, Larry, I have developed a what I call now is my climate science business card. And it's posted on my web on the front page. You can actually click there. You can download it and print it and pass it around. It also can be used as a bookmark to remind us about the single most challenge that humanity faces, that is global warming, and what we must do about it, what we must do now about it. So I invite you, Larry, and everyone in the listening audience to have a look there and to think and act about this very daunting challenge that we have.
And what have you got coming up? Have you got anything?
Oh, well, we've been all over the place. We, you know, take the Sciences Fund truck, different parts of the state. We were in Neenah. We were in Richland Center. We're going to Highland. We're going to be part of Earth Day in Madison at the Monona Terrace all day Monday. We're going to Baraboo. We're just all over the place. We get so many invitations. I'm grateful for the great interest that people have in what we do. And we try to honor and respond positively to all the requests. Unfortunately, I can't do that, but that should not stop anyone from making contact with us through the website, and we'll see what we can work out.
Yeah, and it's your website again?
scifund.org, scifun.org. And Larry, so that you and your guests would remember it, here's a sticker for you. And one for your engineer here.
Tyler gets one, too.
And we'll give one to Jill when we see her.
Bassam, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. A lot of fun talking with you today. Bassam Shakashiri, he'll be back, in a few months, and we'll talk with him again about science. And we'll probably pick up something other than the periodic table, I'm sure. But he's always happy to answer your questions. Well, coming up, we're going to be talking about the women in the United States who changed soccer, the U.S. women's national soccer team. There's a new book out about it, and it's fascinating. Caitlin Murray will be our guest. We'll talk with her next on the Ideas Network, so you stay with us.